You're listening to The Murder in My Family, brought to you by Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including Missing Persons,
DNA ID,
Scene of the Crime,
Zodiac Speaking,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
Citizen Detective,
and
Campus Killings.
All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
The views and opinions expressed by guests on this podcast do not necessarily represent those of the podcast, its host, or sponsors.
If you would like to discuss the murder in your family on this podcast, please be sure to visit themurderinmyfamily.com for more information.
This episode may contain unsettling material or subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Hey, listeners. This is Mike Morford, host of The Murder of My Family, and I want to let you know that I'm away working on some things related to the show. This episode is a re-release of an episode from The Murder of My Family Vault, Episode 9, The Case of Rachel Runyon, and a segment of Episode 68, Case Updates, which includes a conversation with private investigator Jason Jensen, who's worked doggedly on Rachel's case. Rachel's case is one that, for reasons you'll hear in this episode, touched me and influenced me from a young age, and really made me aware of the fact that there's true evil in this world. And it's a case that I continue to pray will be solved soon. Think of Rachel and her brave mom, Elaine, as you listen to this episode. We'll dive into this case after some quick housekeeping. Independent podcasts like this one depend on word of mouth to bring in new listeners. So if you find that you enjoy this show, please take a moment to rate and review it wherever you listen to your podcast. And be sure to introduce a friend to the show and invite them to listen. With your help, The Murder of My Family can continue to grow and reach a new audience. To learn more about the show or the cases we discuss, please visit themurderofmyfamily.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @MurderMyFam or on Facebook at facebook.com/TMIMFpodcast. If you'd like to support The Murder of My Family and get VIP access to things like ad-free listening, early preview episodes, and bonus content of not only this show, but for every other podcast on the Abjack Network of Indie Podcast, consider subscribing to the show with an Abjack Insider subscription through Apple Podcast. For only $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year, you'll unlock a variety of listener benefits and you'll be supporting the show in the process. Your support is greatly appreciated.
And thank you to all of the supporters that generously donate to help keep the show growing and improving. One last note, please support any of the sponsors that you hear on The Murder of My Family the way that those sponsors support the show. It's with our sponsor support that this show can go on and continue to provide a platform to share these stories with you in every episode. Thank you. And now on with the show.
Thanks for joining me for episode 9 of The Murder of My Family. I need to warn you up front that although every murder case I've covered to this point is uniquely awful for the victims and their families, this episode deals with an especially difficult subject that just may be too hard for some listeners to hear. It deals with the unsolved murder of a 3-year-old child named Rachel Runyon. As a parent myself, I can fully understand one's reluctance to listen to this episode, but I also feel it's important to share this story, especially because this episode will air one day before the 36-year anniversary of Rachel's murder. If you feel that you need to hit stop and abandon this episode, now's the time to do it. No hard feelings. If you're ready to dive into one of the most heartbreaking cases I've ever dug into, let's move forward. I was 17 years old in 1989, and unlike most teenagers my age, I was totally obsessed with the true crime television show Unsolved Mysteries. I was fascinated by the mysteries they presented each week, but it was on November 8th of that year when I watched an episode of the show that taught me that evil truly did exist in this world. That's when I first learned about the Rachel Runyon case, and it left an indelible impression on me. On August 26, 1982, 3-year-old Rachel Runyon played outside of her house, only 15 feet away from where her mother, Elaine, prepared lunch. Rachel, along with her two older brothers,
were lucky enough to live right next to a school and playground in the town of Sunset, Utah. It wasn't long before a man approached the group of kids and began offering them ice cream and bubblegum. The man was able to gain Rachel's trust and, without warning, grabbed the innocent 3-year-old and threw her into his car before speeding away. Rachel's young brothers watched helplessly. The boys immediately ran into their house and told their mother what had happened. And horrified, Elaine called police. When the police arrived, they quickly started the search for little Rachel. The only eyewitnesses, Rachel's own brothers, were able to give a detailed description of the man that had taken Rachel and of the car that he drove. They described to police that the man was thin, about 6 feet tall, had a mustache, and was African American. They felt he was possibly in his late 20s or early 30s. The car he drove was a blue mid-sized car with distinct wood grain panels on the sides. Despite the descriptions of the man and his car, no leads were generated, and the immediate search revealed no signs of Rachel. With such specific details about the abductor and his car, in an area that had an African-American population of less than 2%, it was frustrating that a suspect wasn't quickly identified. Rachel's family and her community were devastated that something like this could happen there, and all they could do was wait and hope that Rachel would be found quickly. Unfortunately, hours turned to days, and days to weeks, with no answer and no signs of Rachel. Then, on September 19, 1982, 24 days after Rachel was abducted, a family that was on a picnic in a secluded area about 20 miles from where Rachel was abducted spotted what appeared to be a doll alongside a creek. They looked closer and discovered what they had seen wasn't a doll, but instead was the lifeless body of a child. Police responded and confirmed that it was the body of Rachel Runyon. The beautiful little blonde-haired Rachel was nude and hogtied. Brush was haphazardly used to try and hide her body. It seems unclear as to whether Rachel was sexually assaulted, and police haven't released all of the details about the crime itself. Investigators worked leads in the case and developed persons of interest, but no arrests were made, and the case went cold, leaving Rachel's family devastated. It was in 1989 when Unsolved Mysteries did the episode about Rachel's case, once again bringing attention to the case that it desperately needed. In the episode, some disturbing things were revealed to the audience, including a police theory that Rachel may have been kidnapped and murdered for the purposes of producing a snuff film. Another possible clue that was revealed in the episode was that there was a message found in the bathroom of a business in the Sunset, Utah area. The message scrawled on the bathroom stall read, "Beware. I'm still at large. I killed the little Runyon girl. Remember, beware." The sinister note was also accompanied by the drawing of an inverted cross and the number 666, leading some investigators to think that the murder of Rachel Runyon may have been related to satanic rituals or cult activity. But there was nothing solid to connect this writing to Rachel's case, and it may have been nothing more than a cruel joke. It wasn't until 2011 when police got what they thought might be a big break in the case. A top suspect in the Runyon case was arrested in Pennsylvania following an Amber Alert. The subject of the alert had taken his 5-month-old son without permission after assaulting his girlfriend. Police were able to locate the man and his son, and luckily the child was not harmed. I won't name the suspect, but there are plenty of details about him online, and he looks almost identical to the description of Rachel's abductor. He had lived in the Sunset, Utah area around the time of Rachel's murder, and a relative of his owned a car that closely matched the one that the abductor was seen driving away in. Police have stated that there's not enough evidence to charge this man in Rachel's murder. I hope that one day there is enough to make an arrest in Rachel's case, whether it's this suspect or another. It's been 36 years since Rachel Runyon's murder, far too long for her family to wait for justice. If there's reason for hope in this case, it's that we've seen other high-profile cold cases solved recently. Again, police have been tight-lipped about what evidence, such as DNA, that they might be holding on to in Rachel's case. We can only hope that the monster that did this will be identified. Although the Rachel Runyon abduction and murder was a horrible crime, there have been some positive things that have resulted from it. Rachel's mother, Elaine, became a staunch advocate for missing children. She was instrumental in the creation of the Missing Children of Utah organization. As a reminder to always think of child safety, and as an honor to Rachel's memory, Utah Representative Steve Handy sponsored legislation in recent years that would make August 26th Rachel Runyon Missing and Exploited Children Day in Utah. Although Rachel's been gone for 36 years, her memory lives on and her case is a reminder to us all to keep our children close and be wary of the monsters that live among us. Elaine Runyon joined me to discuss Rachel's case in what turned out to be an emotional discussion for both of us, and one that for me has been the toughest interview I've had to do so far. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. As a parent of young children, I often have a lot of important discussions about things with them. And just recently, I've been talking to them about the importance of money, how to earn it responsibly, and once you've earned it, how to manage and spend it responsibly. And Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. Set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to your family's needs, and connect them with allowance to reward kids for a job well done. When I was a kid, I'd wash cars, shovel snow, or carry groceries for neighbors in order to earn money. I could only imagine how cool and easy it would have been if the money I earned was deposited in an account right when I earned it. My kids are at that age where maybe they want to splurge on a game or a pair of fancy shoes, and I'm trying to teach them the importance of working for money and spending it wisely. And I think Greenlight can really help them do just that. With Greenlight, your kids build financial literacy and independence by learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. The Greenlight app also comes with an in-app financial literacy game, Level Up, that helps kids build money confidence through videos, bite-sized challenges, mini-games, and more. More than 6 million parents and kids use Greenlight to learn how to make responsible financial choices. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/family. That's greenlight.com/family to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/family. I just want to thank you very much, Elaine, for joining me to discuss Rachel's case.
Oh, you're welcome.
And, you know, we talked a little bit by phone the other day, and I think I relayed to you how much this case affected me personally. It's one of the most, you know, heartbreaking cases that I've ever read about or researched. So I can't imagine how you felt over the years. But you've turned your tragedy into something positive, and we'll definitely talk about that in a little bit. If you can you take us back to that day, August 26th, 1982, and just tell us in your own words what happened that day?
Oh, yes. I've never forgotten a minute of that day. It was a very difficult day. I was just being mama, cooking lunch, making sloppy joes. The kids wanted to go outside my backyard fence, and there's a big toy right there, literally like our toy, even though it belonged to the schools. It was 15 feet from my backyard fence. So they had never got to go over there by themselves, only with me or daddy. And we hadn't lived there that long, and so it was a fun thing to do. But they just kept begging and seeing how happy it would make them. I gave in, you know, even though I was cooking their lunch. I said, yes, but you got to come when I call. And they scampered off, just opened the little gate from our backyard, went over, and they were right there. So I just kept cooking lunch, and I didn't feel good about it. My stomach was nervous because I never let them go over there by themselves. And so I called each child by name. I said, Justin, Rachel, Nathan, and each one answered. So I'm like, okay, they're okay. I'm just being too worried for nothing. And then I go stir the sloppy joes some more, and then I go over to the window again, and they're at the other side of the park, and it was about a football field away, and I'm like, what are they doing over there? So I'm calling out, you know, Justin, bring everyone home. You know, kind of like, what are you doing over there? And he comes running, and he comes in and walks up the steps to the kitchen, and he's like, Mommy, I have some real bad news. And I said, what? And he said, Rachel's in a car. I go, what car? He said, a blue car. I said, whose car? And he said, a black man's. And I'm like, I fell to my knees, and I said, Justin, he'll kill her, he'll kill her. It just sounded bad, and that was my instant reaction. And it was just absolutely horrifying. And so he said he was going to take us to Bobco's for ice cream. And so I put the kids in the vehicle, and we ran over. And I thought, oh, my gosh, how do I ask? Did a black man come in with my little girl, a little blonde, blue-eyed, you know, three-year-old little girl? I just couldn't even hardly say those words because I knew what it sounded like. And even before I asked, I knew they'd say no, because you would remember that. You know, it's an odd combination in 1982. So then we got back in the Land Cruiser, ran back home, and I got on the phone, called my husband at work, and I just said, you know, it's Rachel. She's been kidnapped. And he says, you know, call the police. I'm coming home right now. And the police pulled up 5 minutes later.
How old were your other children at that time, or how old were all the
five,
children?
5 years old and 18 months.
Wow. And
they were always together, always.
Yeah, and you always had an eye on them. They're 15 feet away. You know, you think that that's a pretty reasonably safe distance.
Yeah, and even though I never let him go there, and all my neighbors said, you never let him even play out front, you know, without you, and you're just so careful, and they never are walking up and down the street. You take them to a friend's house, and you pick them up. I'm like, I know. I was really, really careful, and people did not expect this to happen to me. There were other people's little kids that ran around in their underwear in the streets, you know, and not my kids, no way. And then this happened, so it was pretty shocking to everyone.
What goes through a person's mind in your situation during that time? I mean, I couldn't even imagine, you know, as a parent, what do you think about in that circumstance?
Well, for me, I was horrified. My stomach was sick. And to carry it out, I mean, we'll get into that, but I couldn't eat. I couldn't sleep. I was just frightened for her and whatever her surroundings were. And if she was cold, if she needed food, it's so helpless, and it just incapacitates you. It was horrible. I don't like to go back there in that thinking, because it's really painful.
And, you know, in this situation, at least there were witnesses that were able to give some information to the police to help them, you know, your children were able to provide some details.
Yes.
Were you hoping or thinking that there might be a quick resolution, that they might find her right away, since they had such good, accurate, you know, detailed information to go on?
Yeah, I mean, I was hopeful, but I wasn't going to be happy till I had her in my arms, and it's not over till it's over. And so they had roadblocks up within 20 minutes, and just the news was out there, and I just thought, okay, they're going to find my little girl, and the police will take care of it. I didn't know that it was the beginning of a long, long career of missing children and heartache and pain, you know?
And then a month later, you've got all that time going by, and I, you know, again, I can't even imagine what you went through for that month, but then you get the news that they found her body. How did you handle that? I mean, it's, yeah, I can only imagine. I say that because I can't say, you know, I'm not in your shoes, and I don't think anybody can be in your shoes and know what goes through your mind. But what happens in that situation?
Well, after 24 days, the mayor and detective police showed up at my house one evening, and they came to break the news that a family out for a Sunday drive up Trapper's Loop had, you know, went down to a little spring, little river, and they moved some shrubbery, and a doll came up, and they were running back to their family vehicle saying they had found a doll, and the parents went down, and lo and behold, it was my doll. And so it was very sad. I, oddly enough, still had hope, you know. When they said body, does that mean they're dead? They kept saying they found a small child's body. So I'm naive enough at, 26, 27 years old to think there was still hope. I still had hope. And then I learned later, then the 10 o'clock news broke, and we got the story.
This was a small, not a large community, I take it. So I assume this sort of shocked, you know, people in your town.
Oh, yeah. Well, even though it's a small community, Davis County is one of the largest counties in Utah, and being such a high-profile case that also went national, and flyers were being made, translated in languages to go around the world, you know, it's hard to shut down the search once we had so many things going every day for 24 days, right? The news just kept getting bigger and bigger, and we went to New York to be on CNN and the Today Show and share all our stories to keep the word out. And now we had the answer that we had been hoping we wouldn't have, but at the same time, we were grateful because we know how hard we'd been searching every single day, and the fact that she was found in a mountain canyon stream is sheer miracle. So we also knew a miracle was happening compared to the choices we had ahead of us.
And do you think, and you know, I don't know how to phrase this, but is sometimes not having an answer, do you think that would be more difficult than having an answer, than even if it's a bad one? If she was never found, would that have been any worse?
No. I totally believe it was a blessing she was found. And I tell you, the magnitude of the horrendous crime it is when you are thanking God that you have your baby back and she's dead. Does that give you a taste of how horrible the pain is? Think about that.
Yeah, I can't even put myself in your shoes.
Yeah. So we were just so grateful and so blessed that we were able to give her a proper farewell and be able to give her a funeral and be able to put her body to rest, and that we did not have to search the rest of our lives, because if we kept searching and searching, it didn't matter. She was already dead. She was already hidden in a mountain canyon stream. We would have never found her if too much time went by. We had flooding that fall, and we just know how blessed we are that she was found.
Now, you spoke a little bit about the national attention that her case got. You know, I first heard about her case on Unsolved Mysteries when that came out in 1989. And some of the things they talked about in that, you know, in that episode were just, you know, I was 17 at the time. I didn't have any kids. I was still in school myself. But, you know, they talked about Satanism, or that she may have been killed in a snuff film. And I didn't even know what some of that stuff was at the time. And it was just so frightening, you know. Did that make things even worse when you heard details like that?
It was weird, and I just have a strong belief that she was with Heavenly Father, and that I didn't put a lot of stock into that at all. I mean, if there was truth to it, I was willing to get to the bottom of it, but we had no facts. We just had that they cut out, well, excuse me, they didn't cut out. At this time, they put, you know, I know who murdered the Rachel Runyon girl and did an upside-down cross with a 666 on it. And the police cut that wall out and, of course, re-drywalled it and kept that as evidence. And they showed that, and they showed that there was black flowers on the grave. Well, was it roses that died? You know what I'm saying? I'm just kind of practical that way. And we never did find a snuff film. And I didn't know what that was either. I had to have that explained to me, you know, that they make a film while, you know, having sex with a child and killing them. Never heard of such a thing.
At the time when I saw this episode, I had never heard of it either. And when I realized what it was, I was just, it was the first time as a young adult that I knew there were evil, really evil people in this world. And Rachel's case became embedded in me at that point in my mind. And I knew one day if I had kids, I would be scared to even let them out of the house. Just, yep. You know, because of Rachel's case. I mean, she's 15 feet away from you with people, and that still didn't stop them. And that's, I think that's a cautionary thing of you don't want to let them, you know, out of your sight because of that, but you also want to give them some kind of freedom. How do you, what would you say to people like me that are just so scared of stuff like Rachel's case? How do you draw the line between letting them live their lives versus being afraid something's going to happen to them?
Well, you have to have a balance, and I guess age appropriate type of thing. And just, they can't live in a bubble. I mean, you know, do you think I wish for a minute that I hadn't let them go over there? I wish I could change that. But I can't. So what am I supposed to do? You know, do I have to shoot myself? No. I put every ounce of energy into trying to, you know, find my child and get her back. And it was the most horrible thing, but there was no way around it. I had to go through it. And those kids need to be able to play. But they can't play like I did. We would go play in the fields and out at the sewer drains. And, you know, we just had to be home by dinner time, you know, when we heard the whistle blow. We would no more let our kids do that now as the man in the moon, right?
Yeah, it's a different world.
It's a different world. But even at 15 feet from my backyard fence, I still was very careful. You know, I mean, the people that knew me and lived around me, and you know, people were coming into my home going, how is it this clean at a minute's notice? Well, I kept my house. I took care of things. I watched my kids. I didn't know all this was going to happen. I didn't have my house all clean just in case, you know, the media came over. And everyone's like, my house would never look like this at a minute's notice. And I'm like, well, I'm very conscientious, and they knew that. And they cannot believe it even happened to our family. But the fact that it did made everyone more aware that if it could happen to me, it could happen to them. And so everyone became more conscientious because they just knew how careful I was. And I'd go grocery shopping, and all three kids would be in the cart and trying to fit the food in between. I mean, John Walsh, their son, was right shopping with the mom, and he just was off over at another section, and before you knew it, he was gone and found with his head amputated, you know?
Yeah, and it's scary as a parent. It's that feeling when you turn around for a second to look at something on a shelf, and then you turn back around, and your child's gone, and you feel that feeling in your heart, that adrenaline, and then you usually hear them or see them out of the corner of your eye, and then, you know, mm-hmm. I can only imagine that feeling of not seeing Rachel again. How did this affect your other children? How did they handle it? Because they were, you know, there, you know, when the man took her. How have they been over the years in dealing with it?
Well, it's been rough. You know, I think it affects each one of us a different way. Like, each of our family members took a different scar. And mine was, I was fighting to save the world and save all the children, because where were the mothers about kidnapping when this happened? I didn't know anything about such horrible things. Not at all. And so I turned into a crusader, and I don't know, my husband at the time almost seemed like he tried to hide from the limelight, because you don't want to be in it, but we knew publicity was the only way to get our child back, to get the word out, because we knew we couldn't be everywhere, and she could have been taken to cross borders, a rich family, to, you know, adopt her out of the country. We didn't know. We had to try everything we could. My sons had different issues. My youngest son, who was 18 months when she got taken, was like, he became somewhat of a celebrity. Everyone's, oh my goodness, you're Rachel's brother? And so he kind of had that kind of status. And my other son, the one that did the composite and, you know, went under hypnotism and saw the guy and talked to the guy and tried to give us most of the information, he had a lot of trouble. He took on saving people. Like, I know of 8 lives he has saved, whether it was in a drowning or someone having a heart attack while he was on an Eagle Scout 50-miler. So many stories. Me, you know, in a snowmobiling mishap in the middle of nowhere. You know, he got stuck, I got stuck, and he had to crawl half a mile to find me. You know, he was ready to build an igloo and keep us in there for the night till help could come. Like, he's just spent his whole life helping people like that. He just feels like he wishes he could have saved his sister. But he went to some landmark courses and learned that he was 5 years old. He did everything a 5-year-old knew to do. He came and told his mother and got standing ovation for that, by the way, for him to come to that conclusion. I was 5. I didn't do anything wrong, you know?
And what he did do was good in providing so much information, the sketch, the details about the car. And police have suspects in this case. You know, there's there's a very good one that, you know, I think you and I may be in agreement on, could be the person mm-hmm. that did this. And unfortunately, police don't have enough to arrest him. How terrible is that to know that the person that did this might be right out there under police, you know, the police's nose, but they just can't arrest him, and he's been living his life for the rest of these years?
It's really frustrating, and I've gotten into watching, you know, investigation, discovery, and watching those kind of shows, and they're like, we don't have enough evidence, we can't arrest. And you know straight up that that guy's guilty, or that person is guilty, or that girl's, and there's nothing they can do, and they have to keep, and they think of all the loopholes and everything they go through, or DNA, or exhuming the bodies, or just going over everything, evidence again and again, and it's hard. And if they would just confess, you know, but they've talked to him, and he denies it, you know?
If you could talk directly to, you know, if he could hear your voice and you could talk to the person that did this to Rachel, what would you say to him?
Oh, it's really sad. I'd say, how could you do this? How could you hurt that sweet little child that never hurt a fly? Was she screaming? She wanted her parents. She must have been frightened out of her mind. How did you let her be so sad? You know, it's a sad, sad story.
I'm sorry to bring that up too. that's getting me choked up too. I have a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old, so I know that feeling of wanting to protect your children at that age. So let's turn to something that's positive. That's something good that came out of this was you're advocating the things you've done to help other children stay safe and help keep bad people from doing stuff like this.
Well, mostly mine has been an awareness, like keeping Rachel's story out there that this does happen to good people and to people that, you know, are careful, that have families, that have homes, that aren't drug addicts, that, you know, we're just good people. We just had a horrible thing happen because some bad person entered our territory and, you know, took a chance and I guess got away with it so far, but he won't get away with it forever, you know. But I just felt like fighting back, so I started with legislation, whether it was House Bill 209, the Comprehensive Child Kidnapping and Sexual Abuse Act, or the Missing Children's Act, which we passed nationally, and then we passed statewide, and so they sync with each other, and you can put, you know, the kids in the database, or the perpetrators, and match fingerprints, and we're always doing something, and we've had kids safety fairs, and we've done fingerprinting, and I've been involved with people like Sam's Club that if I raise $1,000 they match $1,000. There's just some great people out there that are really into wanting to help and what can they do to help. And just like now, I worked with Representative Steve Handy, and we've got the Rachel Runyon and Missing and Exploited Children's Day passed, and it's August 26 every year, and it's for the state of Utah. And our goal was to not only honor Rachel, but to keep the word and the education out about missing children, that this does happen and that we do need to be careful. And we need to keep that awareness out there to the public so they don't become complacent. And so I have an event on Saturday, the 25th of August, to bring in some keynote, you know, speakers. And Ed Smart's joining us, and the chief of police over my daughter's case, the legislator, Rep Handy, and I've got just the mayor and Paul Murphy, the former Amber Alert coordinator for the state of Utah. So we've got some neat people coming, and we're going to just get educated again, and you've got to keep it in front of people. And so that's another way I do it, but I've spoken at the colleges and done kid safety at the schools and been involved with Rad Kids and just all angles of child safety. It's been a, I guess, 36-year journey.
Well, and I can only say thank you for what you're doing to help other kids, you know, across the country. You know, hopefully the work that you've done has gone a long way to making kids safer and you know, keeping other parents from having to go through the horrible thing that you went through. And you mentioned the anniversary and the stuff you're doing on Saturday the 25th, and that's when this episode is going to air. So we will put that out there on social media and let people know that it is the anniversary and that you're doing some special stuff, you know, to honor Rachel at that time. If there's somebody out there listening that wants to help some way in Rachel's case, whether it's spreading awareness or learning more about it or calling in a tip, what advice can you give them? Where should they go? Who should they contact?
Well, I have a website, and it's called, it's a Facebook page called Justice for Rachel Runyon. And you can find it really easy. It's the only one. And I have leads on there all the time, and I keep those leads, you know, with me, read them, and send them to the police. And some are very interesting, and, you know, you never know. And I just thought, well, this might be an avenue where people can connect. And a lot of people just share their respect or their honor for Rachel. Sometimes there's leads. Sometimes they have their own stories. One guy thought it was his dad. Now, that guy's about, 50, and he thought it was his dad. So I gave all that information to the police, and I've had to put it in their hands. You know, I'm not a detective. I have my job, and I guess that's been educating and keeping awareness to the public, and they have their job, and that's their expertise, and I still pray it'll be solved. You know, they are solving 40-year-old cases.
Yeah, so it's important to keep the information coming in and the tips coming in. If somebody thinks they know something in your area, you should definitely come forward.
Yeah, and so don't hesitate to reach out. We'd really appreciate that.
And then just one last thing. If there's somebody out there listening that's a parent and, you know, God forbid they find themselves going through what you went through, what advice would you give them?
Oh, my goodness. That's kind of a tough one. I don't know. I just tell them, you know, one, you're experiencing the color that nobody knows, and you can't blame yourself. It's natural to blame ourselves because we don't know who took them. We don't know where they are. We don't know. So we blame ourselves. We say, I shouldn't have let him play. I was right here, but I shouldn't have let him play. My gut told me, you know, no, you can't go, but I didn't want to be negative mommy either. And so I gave in, and then it's easy to say, look at the price I have to pay. So I just say, you know, do the best you can. And if this does happen to you, stay strong because it's going to be a tough, rough journey. Most marriages don't make it past 2 years because there's so much pain and everyone blaming everybody, and it's rough. So you just have to, you know, be strong for each other, and, you know.
I just want to thank you, Elaine. I know it wasn't easy, and I, you know, I'm sorry to have bring up all those feelings that you have, but I really appreciate you sharing your story and Rachel's story with us. And, you know, I hope that we can spread the word, and I hope that one day we are getting news that her killer has been captured.
Yeah, that would be great. Well, thank you for your caring and your concern, and hope we can get this solved still.
Rachel Runyon, who was just 3 years old, was abducted from outside of her Sunset, Utah home in front of her brothers in August 1982. Weeks after the abduction, Rachel's body was found, and the investigation of her murder led to the unthinkable possibilities that her case was tied to either a snuff film or to satanic rituals. Despite a composite sketch in Rachel's murder, the case remains unsolved. Rachel's mother, Elaine Runyon, shared with us in Episode 9 her pain and anguish over losing her little girl in such a horrible way. But I'm happy to report that there are new investigative leads. Jason Jensen, a Utah private investigator, has taken on Rachel's cases. He's looking at fresh eyes, and it seems like he may be making progress. He's hoping that someone out there listening may be able to come forward with information. Hi, Jason, and welcome to the Murder of My Family.
Thank you. I appreciate the invite.
No problem. I'm happy to have you on because I know you've got some important stuff you're working on. I guess for the audience, can you start off by telling us a little bit about what you do and what your background is?
Sure. I'm a licensed private investigator in Utah. I am also a co-founder of the Utah Cold Case Coalition and one of the main podcasters of Cold Case Talk.
So you work a lot with these older cases, these ones that are harder to solve.
Yeah, I wouldn't had expected that 5-10 years ago, but yeah, that's exactly where I'm at now.
And do you work, you mentioned being in Utah, do you work cases around the country, or do you focus just right in Utah?
We have done work on other cases out of Utah. My license, just like truck drivers or whatever, you know, you got a home state where your license is, and mine is in Utah.
And you happen to be involved in investigating two high-profile cases out of Utah, two that we cover on this podcast. The first was the case of little Rachel Runyon, which I covered in Episode 9, and the other case, Christine Gallegos, and I covered that in Episode 12. Of course, both of these cases are unsolved, and I guess in any older case where things are evolving or new leads are coming in, new information, or new ways of investigating the cases, that sometimes leads to progress and or potential progress in the cases. Am I correct in assuming that there is already or there may be the potential for new developments in both of these cases?
Yes. We feel like we've in both cases. I'm a fan of your work. I was aware of your coverage of both of these cases in the past. And yeah, I liked even the information that you brought out, which in, for instance, what comes to mind in the Christine Gallegos case was really something new that law enforcement did not pick up. And ironically, both of these cases, Rachel Runyon and Christine Gallegos, I swore off years ago that if I went into cold case work, these were two cases I would not get myself involved in. And so it's ironic that I find myself on the cases and feeling like we were making progress, because the reason why I swore them off is for the Rachel Runyon case, having been such a high profile case, and, you know, I guess being humble, I guess for lack of humility to say you're trying to be humble, that I never thought I'd be able to look at the case any differently than all these experts had previously done to see anything new or profound to make a difference, right? Do you understand that? Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't think that I could make any contribution that hadn't already been exhausted. So I thought for sure that particular case got, just because so many eyes have already looked at it, I doubted that I could do anything that would benefit. Anyway, so those two cases I swore I'd never get involved in, and I'm glad I did.
Let's shift gears a little bit to Rachel's case. Now, obviously, yes, yes. There's a different thing at play. This seems to be a straight stranger abduction of a young child, which is, you know, the odds are when a kid, you know, a child goes missing, most of the time it's someone they know. It's not usually a stranger. Everybody, you know, I think every parent out there, including myself, is always on the lookout for strangers. But I think most of the time, if I'm not mistaken, that's not who you have to worry about when it comes to your kids. But in Rachel's case, it definitely seems like it was a stranger abduction, correct?
Oh, yes, 100%. Yeah, we full-heartedly believe this was a stranger abduction. And this abductor, you know, just took advantage of the opportunity that she and her brothers were playing without their immediate parental supervision. So the mother was watching from her window because the playground was only 15 feet away from their yard, and they had just installed a gate because Rachel's brother was just about to start kindergarten, so just the following week. So the kid begged to go over there while she was preparing lunch, so she felt it was safe to let him just, you know, go beyond the border of their property long enough for her to finish their lunch, and then she'd call him back in to eat. Little did she know that there was lurking about a, you know, ominous figure with bad intentions.
Yeah, I think for me personally, that was when Rachel's case came out. I think I first heard about it on Unsolved Mysteries. A lot of people probably did, but I was a teenager when I saw that on that show, and I remember thinking, when I grow up and have kids, they're not going to go out of my sight. That's the first time I realized that there were people out there that were capable of doing evil things. Now, of course, she was found dead, but amazingly, I think it's amazing anyway, that there was a lot of detail provided early on about a car, about a suspect, that to me, I get frustrated when you have some things that were pretty clear all these years that didn't lead to anyone. With the new developments that you're working on, is there a reason to believe that maybe all that stuff that we've had for years wasn't completely accurate?
Yes, yes, and I was going to mention that if you didn't give me a segue, but I'm glad you did. What ended up happening that I observed firsthand just this past weekend, for instance, this last weekend, Rachel's mother and myself went through some old news coverage from 1982 to the present, and we're talking 10 hours, everything from a talk show that they've been on, all the primetime news, local news, regional news, CNN coverage that had happened. Especially intriguing was those first hours and days and weeks. What was interesting that I learned, and the reason why the case is where it's at, is let's set the stage for a second. It's August 82. In fact, on the 26th, which is just 6 days away, will literally be the 38th anniversary. This happened on August 26, 1982. So media compared to now, it was completely different. You know, now we got a 24-hour news cycle. You know, we got cable news, and we're just constantly being drowned with news. Social media shares and everything else. And today we have Amber Alerts, things like that, something like that. Back in 1982, there was no such critter. In fact, in 1982, you would dial the operator. We didn't even have the 911 system for Sunset, Utah at the time. So what happened was, when you get the news coverage, you'd have the two local newspapers. Oh, and there was a regional one. So we had the Standard Examiner for northern Utah that covered even Sunset area. Then you had the statewide ones, you know, the Deseret News and the Salt Lake Tribune. That's the print media. Then you had just three channels, Channel 2, Channel 4, and Channel 5. You'd get your news at 6 o'clock, you'd get your news at 10 o'clock. A couple hours later, the stations would sign off for the night. So if you missed the news, you didn't see the news, right? So, and you didn't have TiVo, you didn't have on-demand or anything like that, if you just didn't see the news. And so the news at that time covered this case. It covered it extensively. But one thing that I noticed is how details of the abductor devolved quickly over time. For instance, what I noticed in that coverage is that one of the channels even depicted two sketches where you're probably familiar, because I was only familiar with the one. And if you looked at the second sketch, you'd see that the second sketch actually had the same skin tone, had the same basic descriptions, mustache, afro hair, things like that. But that face and the facial features actually looked more Hispanic. So I believe that quickly over time, there was it went from a broad description to a narrow one, and it got so focused on the African-American appearing sketch that it excluded all other possibilities, including, you know, a Dominican with an afro, or you know, a Polynesian with an afro, or things like that, because, you know, there's more than one dark-complected, brown-complected, you know, ethnicity in our world. But if you just focus on that he's African-American or something, rather than your neighbor who may have been Hispanic and otherwise also fit the description, you're not going to call the police on it. And that's what we've learned in our investigation. We feel pretty confident that we know who did this. He has a Hispanic background rather than African-American. So I thought I was bringing out new information when I talked to Justin this past January, December timeframe, that the guy had a gap in the philtrum, which is that little reservoir underneath your nose. But in reviewing this original 1982 footage, they even talked about it there, but it was lost in the annals of history. We don't hear that. We don't see that printed anywhere, because, you know, great websites like Web Sleuths and these other, you know, true crime enthusiast sites, they're talking about the things that they've come across in more modern times. They're not looking at stuff, because stuff in 1982 wasn't readily available for us all to explore it. So I thought I was presenting new information. All I've done is revive original description back out to the public. And when we did that, we got a hit. I pointed out that from the details that were known to us, that, you know, the description was a little bit off. You know, we're looking for someone that had a gap in his philtrum. We're looking for somebody that was a local. One of the things that distracted investigators, that led, in my opinion, investigators to look elsewhere outside of the state, was there was some story that somebody saw a truck driver with a little girl. And so that really opened the thoughts, the worry that this was an international or interstate kidnapping, and that they needed to look elsewhere. And that's one of the reasons within a week, Rachel's parents were on CNN trying to get national exposure, because they were afraid that their daughter was no longer in Utah. And that's before they found her body just a, you know, 3 weeks later, still local. So that should have dispelled any belief that this was an interstate killer. And the other fact that I noticed right away was when I was listening that this killer enticed her for some bubble gum, and she says, "I like ice cream," so he offered to take her to Bobco's. That was a local area grocery chain. So if the killer knew Bobco's, it wasn't some truck driver driving through, right? So
someone that has a connection to that store knows that store from the area, it sounds like.
That's right. So instantly, what I then shared with social media was the fact that we're looking for somebody that was not necessarily African-American, but, you know, had a light brown complexion, had an afro and a mustache and the gap in his philtrum, and he was local because of the Bobco's thing. And because, you know, Rachel's remains were found within 15 miles from home rather than, you know, some isolated area out of state. So when I presented that stuff, you know, and a lot of people have lived in the Sunset area in 82, have moved out, but they still follow Rachel Runyon's page that her mother created. And when that information was shared, we got a response. Somebody that even believed that their family thought it was their uncle, but didn't turn him in because he wasn't African American. And so we shared that information with Sunset Police, and they've shared it with the Attorney General's office, who has taken over the investigation. And we're hoping that through their DNA testing that will confirm that this guy that was in our lead matches the killer.
A couple points. I want to come back to the DNA, but a couple things you referenced talking to Justin. For people that are familiar with the case, Justin is Rachel's brother, who was with her and provided many of the details in those descriptions of this man that took her. And I think, what was he, 5 at the time?
Yes, he was her older brother who was 5. And he gave a detailed account of the killer. Likewise, a 10-year-old also in the park, and his name was Sean, he gave a description. That's why there was 2 sketches.
And they both...
And it makes sense to me, but at the time, it's like, why are 2 descriptions yielding 1 sketch? Well, they didn't, but they just favored 1 sketch over the other.
And that's the one they went with. And I've always been amazed that kids were able to provide, at that age, were able to provide some detailed descriptions, and not just of them, but of the car, right?
Exactly. But, you know, a 10-year-old's going to recognize blue, green, red. So it was probably fairly easy for the description of the vehicle to come forth because, you know, it was just simply a blue hatchback mid-sized car with brown wood grain panels.
Had you narrowed that down to a specific make or model? I know you had been talking about certain makes and models in the past.
Yes. We believe that it was and bear in mind, the Mercury Bobcat was the, you know, the Mercury is always an upgraded version of a Ford. And the equivalent of the Mercury Bobcat is the Ford Pinto. So we have insights that this vehicle was either a blue Mercury Bobcat with the wood grain panels, or it was a Pinto with the wood grain panels.
Yeah, and when you
and it's hard to confirm. It's hard to confirm the ownership or what the actual make and model is, you know, 38 years later, because those DMV records aren't available, and the parents that own the vehicle that of this uncle have long passed away. So we can't interview them.
Yeah, and that seems what makes it even more frustrating, because you've got this pretty unique looking car with a description, whether it's black, Hispanic, whatever they may be, they're a darker skin, but you have a general idea of what they look like driving that car. That's one of the frustrating things, that you seem like you'd have a good head start with that. And the fact that it's just not solved after all these years is very frustrating. But back to the DNA, and that may be where the ultimate solving of the case could come. There's the police haven't been very vocal about what they have or what they don't have. Can you talk about that a little bit as far as do they have enough to rule people out? Do they have enough to do genealogy, that kind of stuff?
Well, I'm certainly not at liberty to share information along that because that's their investigation. If I have information, it's just because I'm blessed to have that, so I cannot confirm or deny I have anything. But
okay.
We do feel confident that from an outsider looking in, that they should be able to confirm the identity of this guy if, in fact, our lead and everything is right.
And the fact that there's any kind of progress, you know, decades later is pretty promising. And just, I think we see in the news all these cases getting solved, and it just gives us hope for these two cases. Now, and the most important thing I want to put out here is if someone has information about either of these cases, should they contact you directly or go to the Facebook pages? What are the best ways to contact you with this information?
They're more than welcome to call me directly. My cell phone number is 801-759-2248. But they're probably better off trying to reach through us after they search through either the Justice for Rachel Runyon page that's managed by her mother or the Christine Gallegos Connections page on Facebook that I manage. So that way they get a chance to, you know, look at posts and refresh their memory and make sure that they're not wasting their time. And one of the things that I would like to add is that the Utah Cold Case Coalition, which I'm a founder of, we are always promoting August as Cold Case Month, which is how Steve got a hold of me initially in the Christine Gallegos case. Cold Case Month works. We wouldn't be where we are on Christine Gallegos without promoting Cold Case Month. And what's unique about this Cold Case Month is that we are offering a $10,000 reward, an increase from $5,000 for any information that helps us clear up Christine's case or resolve Rachel's case.
And then I always hope people come forward and do the right thing, not for money, but if it's money that helps solve these cases, so be it. As long as someone does come forward with information, that would be great. I can't thank you enough for coming on to talk about these cases. They're two big ones that I covered and ones that I hope to see solved, obviously, for Rachel's mom, Elaine, and her family, and then for Steve and his family. And they've been waiting a long time for justice, and I think they're really lucky to have you working alongside them. I hope you guys catch a break. Thank you once again for joining me for this episode of The Murder of My Family. I'd like to thank Sonny Landon for writing and research assistance in this episode. We'll be back here soon with an all-new episode of The Murder of My Family, and I hope you'll join me for it. But before you go, remember that every murder victim means something to somebody.